NPR Music presents this encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. We'll hear about the life and music of Oscar Peterson. He passed away in 2007 at the age of 82.
I consider Oscar Peterson to be the most dynamic pianist in the history of jazz.
Oscar is what I'd call a complete piano player. In fact, he does use both hands and all 10 fingers.
What can I say about O.P.? He is just absolutely the epitome of the profession.
Peterson is a great pianist who happens to play jazz. He's an inspired and driven artist, trained in the classical tradition of Franz Liszt, but nurtured on Art Tatum and Nat King Cole. On stage, he is a giant of a man, radiating confidence from the concert grand, which looks, next to him, like a mere toy. As a composer and arranger alone, Oscar Peterson has made significant contributions to the history of jazz. But Oscar Peterson, the pianist, is the standard to which an awful lot of jazz pianists aspire.
He's got the dexterity to play and build. He's got the dynamics. He's got the harmonics. And he's got, which is most important, the swing.
I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, we celebrate Oscar Peterson's half century as one of the giants of jazz. As a player, as a composer, as a collaborator, and as a teacher, Oscar Peterson's influence has been felt throughout the world of jazz. From 1950 onward, he dominated Downbeat magazine's critics' polls. But most importantly, Oscar Peterson advanced the history of jazz piano by weaving together its various traditions.
There simply is not, and never has been, in all of jazz, there's never been a pianist with Oscar's incredible command of the instrument.
Gene Lees has written The Will to Swing, a biography of Oscar Peterson.
Well, first of all, he's incredibly fast. The speed alone is not the sole measure of technique in playing any instrument, in least of all in piano. But there's a chordal balance. The way he plays chords, the way he plays ballads, the way he plays up-tempo things, the way he swings, the way he makes everything swing. Rhythmically, I don't think there's ever been a pianist hit with the propulsive force that he has.
Behind the propulsive force of Oscar Peterson is a classically trained musician. As a youth, Oscar had studied with Paul DeMarchi, who himself had studied with a pupil of Franz Liszt. Oscar became a pianist in the great romantic tradition. And he says his affiliation with DeMarchi had a great influence on his development as a musician.
He appreciated not only the classical medium, but he was very interested in the jazz medium. And I never felt ill at ease with him because we could talk just as easily about some of the classical pieces that I was attempting to learn as we would about some of the jazz things that I was attempting to do at that time. And so because of that, I never felt left out insofar as the learning process.
That learning process began at a very early age, 400 miles north of New York City, in the historic port city of Montreal. At the time of Oscar's birth, August 15, 1925, there were only some 2,000 blacks living in the city, and most of them lived in a tough part of town.
I was brought up in the Saint-Henri district of Montreal, and you had to be a sort of a fighter of sorts to exist there, especially if you were Jewish or black and French, because all factions at one time seemed to be carrying on their own private little wars. But nevertheless, because of that, I think that I learned that if you really believe in something and if you have something to hold on to, in my case it was music, it was jazz, that prevails above all else.
If you were a black man living in Montreal at the time, the railroads were pretty much the only choice you had for a career. Oscar's father was a railway porter, and he determined that his five children would never have to work for the railroad as he did. So he trained them all musically. Oscar began trumpet lessons when he was five, but gave up the instrument when he had to spend a year convalescing from a bout of tuberculosis. At the age of eight, he began to take piano lessons from his older sister, Daisy, and he knew that he'd found his voice. As a young child, Oscar would practice for hours every day. His mother had to drag him away from the keyboard at bedtime. Pianist Oliver Jones grew up with Oscar Peterson.
I think the thing that impressed me the most about Oscar was I think he was always very, very determined that he knew exactly what he wanted to do at a very early age, which was very, very unusual. And he was totally focused. And in those days, there wasn't that many young black men in any field, I think, that really dared to challenge the status quo at that time.
Oscar began playing jazz in dance bands while he was in high school, where one of his musical partners was trumpeter Maynard Ferguson. They both played in a band called the Victory Serenaders, and according to Maynard Ferguson, they hung out in St. Henri's jazz clubs, where they caught some of the best jazz there was.
There was two black clubs called St. Michel and Rockhead's Paradise. And anytime there was a name band in town, a name jazz band in town, everybody would know that as soon as the concert was over, they would be jamming. And so it was the place to go to hear some of the great American jazz musicians that would come in with Ellington, Basie, Kenton, Woody, whoever.
It was at this time that the 14-year-old Oscar Peterson entered and won a radio talent show. This led to regular appearances on Canada's national network, the CBC.
Oscar Peterson, friends, delight, we'd like you to meet a colored boy whose amazing fingers have been cutting a rhythmic, blazing path to success over the airwaves for the past 3 years now. 3 years back, Oscar, then 15, won a nationwide new talent contest. And today, still going to school, he manages to make his presence felt on as many occasions as his homework will allow, filling engagements over the radio networks. Here's Oscar Peterson with his version of Boogie Woogie Cocktail.
I won the amateur show and started to get a little recognition around Montreal. They sort of bent the rules for me. I would sneak into a couple of the clubs and get to hear some of the local musicians who could really play. And they were a great influence on me because they took care of me. They would not tolerate me going right or left, behaviorally speaking. They insisted that, you know, if I came up into that medium, I was not to get into trouble because they felt very responsible to my parents.
time Oscar won the talent show, one of Montreal's leading dance bands was led by trumpeter Johnny Holmes. Oscar joined Holmes in 1942 at the age of 17 and stayed for 5 years. With Holmes, Oscar changed direction, evolving from a boogie-woogie pianist to one who swung hard. He also learned how to compose and arrange. Oscar became a sensation, and eventually visiting jazz musicians like tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins and trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie took notice and spread the word. Oscar began getting serious offers from some of the finest band leaders.
I know Bill Basie spoke to me and tried to get me to go to the States with the band. I kept wondering what he wanted with two piano players. I couldn't figure that one out. Jimmy Lunser had heard me play and decided that he wanted me to join his band. I was too young at the time. My mother had misgivings about me going to the States at that particular age, and my father wasn't that crazy about it at the time. And my mom would always say, "Your time will come, be patient." Those are her words.
Oscar was patient. He left the Johnny Holmes Orchestra to form his own trio with bass and drums, and he continued to wait. Finally, his time did come, with a little help from Norman Granz. Granz was an American jazz entrepreneur and record company executive who had created a touring company of jazz all-stars called Jazz at the Philharmonic. The year was 1949, and Granz was in Montreal for an upcoming concert. He was already on his way out of town when he had a fateful encounter with Oscar Peterson.
He heard a radio broadcast, a local broadcast that I was doing while he was in the cab on the way to the airport. And he didn't know who it was, and he asked who that was, and the cab driver replied that it was me. And he said, "Well, are those records or what?" He said, "No, no, no, he's playing. That's a live broadcast." So Norman said, "Where's he playing?" He said, "The Alberta Lounge." He said, "Well, let's turn around, let's go there." Got a chance to talk to him after the set. He sat down and talked to him, and he said, "You know, I think it'd be great if you came to the States." And I said, "Well, I don't know if I'm ready to come to the States." He said, "Oh, I think you should. I think you're more than ready." He said, "Why don't you come down and appear with Jazz at the Philharmonic at Carnegie Hall?"
And Oscar did. Oscar was sitting in the Carnegie Hall audience when Norman Granz surprised the crowd and invited him to join the group.
Now for the second show, we have a surprise for everybody. Up in Canada, there's been a very wonderful piano player. And all the bands that have traveled through Canada have heard him and raved about him. Today, he flew to New York to hear our concert. And I saw him in the audience, and I prevailed upon him to join our group. I think he's very wonderful. It's something you ought to hear because we think he's going to be one of the coming giants of jazz. From Canada, his first appearance in the United States, Oscar Peterson.
Thank you.
Fine and Dandy, Oscar Peterson's Carnegie Hall debut in 1949. Clearly believing in what the young Canadian pianist had to offer, Grants became Oscar's manager. He followed up the debut with an extensive Jazz at the Philharmonic tour in 1950. Grants paired Oscar with bassist Ray Brown to form the backbone of the company's rhythm section. Oscar was backing the leading American jazz artist of the day.
We're playing with greats like Coleman Hawkins and Dizzy Gillespie and Lester Young is, in my opinion, the best education you can have musically as a jazz musician. I can't think of anything as great. And there can't be anything as great because the diversity in their playing one-on-one was such that you had to grow within that spectrum.
By 1953, the musicians of Jazz at the Philharmonic were enduring a grueling schedule. They played 75 concerts that year in North America, another 50 concerts in Europe, and 24 concerts in Japan. At times, it was exhilarating.
Time I was with Oscar and Jazz at the Philharmonic. We went to Japan in 1953.
Guitarist Herb Ellis.
And we were the first big jazz tour to ever go over there. And I remember that Ray Brown and I were sitting together on the airplane, and as we taxied up, we looked out and we just saw throngs of people. And I said to Ray, I wonder who they're for. He said, I don't know. He said, I think there's a senator on the plane. And by golly, they were for us. And they put us in the open top car and gave us a ticker tape parade. It was awesome.
Oscar and the other stars of Jazz at the Philharmonic didn't always encounter such a friendly reception while on the road. The picture was very different when the group toured the American South.
I remember one instance that we got in this concert hall a little early, and I had to use the gents' room. And I remember they had policemen, Norman had to hire policemen to keep, you know, everything in order. That was part of the deal, I guess, with the hall. And I went in the men's room, and the policeman saw me going. I guess he didn't get to me in time. And he came to the door and started hollering and banging on the door, saying, come out of there, come out of there. You can't use that toilet. That's a white toilet. And someone ran and got Norman. And Norman came back and went up to this cop and said, you know, I got bad news for you. He said, I rented this hall tonight. That means I own the hall for the evening. You went with the hall, so you're working for me. And I happen to own these washrooms. And I say that any one of my artists can use any washroom in here they want to use as long as I own this hall. So don't harass them anymore.
I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR's Jazz Profiles with a portrait of Oscar Peterson. For the early days of JATP, Oscar Peterson and Ray Brown acted as the rhythm section that regularly backed all the soloists that toured with the company. But in 1952,
Grant suggested that the rhythm section expand to a trio, which could on occasion tour on its own. With the example of the Nat King Cole Trio firmly in mind, Oscar approached guitarist Herb Ellis. And so began one of the most exciting and productive times of Oscar's career. From the start, Oscar had an ideal sound in mind. This trio was not going to be piano with bass and guitar accompaniment. Instead, this would be a group that thought and played as one. This meant they had to chart a new course. All their arrangements had to be fresh. Rehearsals were long and tough. Oscar was a hard taskmaster. Bassist Ray Brown.
He would write an arrangement on something, and we would play it at a nice, even tempo. And then when we finally felt like we had it under our hands, he would start playing it faster. So you would scuffle with it a little more. Then you would get it on your hands. As soon as you got it again, then he would jack it up a little higher, you know. It was a challenge all the time.
Most jazz trios have a drummer to propel the rhythm. Herb Ellis was such a powerfully rhythmic guitarist that he more than made up for the lack of drums.
To take the place of the drum at times, I played a bongo effect on the guitar. And it's very close to what a bongo would play. The bongo effect you do by turning on the volume and muting the strings, not pushing the strings completely down, just getting kind of a sound, you know, and that'll give you the effect.
Oscar Peterson.
Herbie and I used to practice phrasing together. In other words, if we had guitar playing the lead with piano, we practice breathing at the same points in the song, in the melody, rather than having it being delivered by two individuals. It had to be delivered as one. And we had tried to keep that same impetus when we were playing for each other.
Oscar was as tough on himself as he was on the other members of the trio. Herb Ellis.
Playing with Oscar is it's very hard because he demands the best from you, but he does the same for himself. And we rehearsed a lot, but he made very complicated arrangements, and your parts were very, very difficult, but he made his parts difficult too. And many times I'd say to Oscar at rehearsal, I'd say, Oscar, I can't play this. And I was serious, and he'd say, yes, you can, Herb. I said, if you couldn't play it, I wouldn't have given it to you. And I would work on it 2 or 3 days, and by golly, I'd have it.
A cohesion about this trio that made for chamber jazz at its finest. The group concentrated on delicate ensemble work, rich in tonal color and harmonic inventiveness. Like Olympic rowers, they pulled together in perfect synchrony. The trio rehearsed relentlessly and occasionally surpassed even its own high standards. In 1956, the musicians gathered to play a concert at the Stratford Shakespearean Festival in Ontario. Norman Granz was there to record the trio playing live. There was magic in the air.
I think we reached an apex that evening.
Bassist Ray Brown.
I knew we were playing not outside per se, but we were playing in a tent up in Canada. And it was very warm, hot night, and the place was full. And it was a wooden stage, as you can tell by the feet on the stage if you listen to that album. But the group was really performing great that night. And some of Oscar's more vibrant arrangements were played that night.
Working together as closely as they did, the members of the trio occasionally had to let off a bit of steam. They learned about each other's weaknesses, and this led to an ongoing series of practical jokes. Oscar's old schoolmate, Maynard Ferguson.
We had rented this house for the season, and we were sitting around this big, huge fireplace telling typical jazz stories, you know. And Herb had one of those, I used to call it bebop cases for his guitar. I mean, they're just the soft leather. And he had it leaning against a post that was in the middle of the living room. And so Oscar sneaked off. And he had seen some firewood, the kindling, I should say, right? So he took the guitar out of the case, put the kindling into the guitar case, and then put this case back, and it looked like, of course, the guitar was in it, you know? And then Oscar went to the bathroom or made some excuse, and then, of course, purposely tripped and just sat down on this leather guitar case. And of course you heard the crunching of the kindling, and then Herb could not understand why we were laughing. And then eventually we all really laughed.
Peterson Trio with Noreen's Nocturne, recorded in 1956 at the Stratford Shakespearean Festival in Ontario. The trio with Herb Ellis is regarded by some as the best of its kind ever. It was a group based on love and an almost telepathic level of communication. Oscar experienced quite a crisis when, after 6 years, Herb Ellis decided he'd had enough of life on the road and left the trio. Oscar wrestled with what to do next. He realized Herb Ellis would be hard to replace. Oscar was also ready to move ahead with his own playing. He decided not to find another guitarist. Instead, he would bring in a drummer. And the challenges of adapting to the new group launched Oscar on a new phase of his career. That's just ahead. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Oscar Peterson from NPR, National Public Radio. With the departure of his hard-swinging guitarist, Oscar Peterson and his bassist, Ray Brown, needed a third leg for the trio. Oscar decided to replace Herb Ellis with a drummer, a more standard trio format. In the spring of 1959, he brought Ed Thigpen into the trio. By losing the interplay of piano and guitar that he'd had with Herb Ellis, Oscar replaced one whole set of challenges with a new one. Peterson biographer Gene Lees.
Now, the problem with that first trio, and any trio with guitar, bass, and drums, is you're dealing with two harmonic instruments. Both can play chords. And the trick is not to get in each other's way. So it requires a particular kind of approach to the playing. I mean, when Herb is giving you this powerful rhythmic thing and taking care of the chords, Oscar has to sort of leave that left hand alone a lot. But Ed Thigpen came in on drums, and that totally changed the character of the group, because now he could play all of these harmonic textures that he'd had to be sort of cautious about with Herb.
The Brown Thigpen Trio maintained the tight cohesiveness of the original group with guitar. Thigpen was a delicate, almost melodic drummer, and he was steeped in the jazz tradition. One admirer called him an encyclopedia of jazz drumming. During the trio years, Oscar continued to live in Canada. In 1958, he moved from Montreal to Toronto, where, along with Ray Brown, Ed Thigpen, and clarinetist Phil Nimmons, he opened the Advanced School of Contemporary Music, Canada's first school for jazz musicians. He continued his academic interest. In 1985, he was named a professor of music at York University in Toronto. And in 1991, he was named Chancellor of the University. It was while the school was in full swing in the early 60s that Oscar began to compose in earnest. One of his earliest and most significant works is an extended tonal portrait of his native country. The composing of Canadiana Suite began one day while the trio was playing in Chicago, with a bit of prodding from Ray Brown.
I had been messing with Ray as usual that day, that one afternoon in Chicago. And he said to me, "Why don't you do something productive? Why don't you go write something?" So I went back to my room, and the first thing I wrote was Wheatland. And after I wrote it, I said to myself, you know, that to me that's very reminiscent of the placid fields of wheat in Western Canada. And I went back to Ray's room and said, "Well, I've done it. How's this?" And I taught it to him. It progressed from that one piece to my thinking about the various parts of Canada that I knew about.
The part of Canada Oscar knew best was the St. Henri district of downtown Montreal, the place where he had grown up. It inspired the liveliest section of the Canadiana suite.
Place Saint-Henri was written for my little portion of Montreal that I lived in when I was a youngster. And the people down there are very energetic. They go about their daily chores. And it was a bustling, I thought it was a bustling community because it was ethnically mixed. And everyone had something going. There were Italians, there were blacks, there were obviously French, there were Irish. And of course we had our loves and our disagreements. And it was on this basis that I wrote that tune.
In the 60s, Oscar Peterson faced a whole series of challenges. He had already adapted his trio to a new style with drums instead of guitar, and he was busy composing and teaching. Then, the unthinkable happened. After 15 years, Ray Brown called it quits. Instead of being discouraged, Oscar rose to the occasion. He set out on a new career as a solo pianist. It all began on a German tour during the final days of the trio. Writer Gene Lees.
There's a guy in Germany named Hans-Georg Brunner-Schwer who's very, very wealthy. And he was a music lover. And he had a superb piano in his living room. And he would bring in various people and pay them full money and have them just sit there and play that piano, and he'd tape the stuff.
He had bought a particular piano that he wanted me to play, and it was a gorgeous instrument. We decided that it'd be a good idea to do a solo album, because he said, you know, you do so many things, so many ways. I'd like to hear you without having to worry about what you're doing with anybody else. And as a result, we turned out the solo albums. It's very different playing solo piano, because when you play solo piano, you know, the world is your world. And you can do anything you want. You can turn any corners you want without having to alert anybody that you're going around the corner. Or you can turn right and go the other way and you don't have to signal anybody musically. And if you want to change tempo, you can do that. You can do anything, change key. You don't have to be responsible to anyone other than yourself and the piano. And there was a freedom that was available during those performances that could not be available during any of the group performances. It's a different thing altogether.
Oscar had always had his critics. But his newfound freedom as a solo player helped to silence those who regarded his work as either too busy, too much like Art Tatum, or too predictable. Jazz critic Whitney Balliot perhaps best summed up this critical point of view. In 1970, he wrote in the New Yorker magazine, quote, Peterson is difficult to listen to without automatically hearing in the mind his model and master, Art Tatum. He is a massive man with massive technique, but he lacks Tatum's touch, his inspired harmonic madness, and his subtle, infallible rhythmic sense. Criticism like this stung Oscar. He was driven a perfectionist and an individualist. He felt critics like Balliet missed the point and forgot about the essence of jazz.
That's where I think they misread it. They look at ability and say, he can play fast or he can play this many notes. You have to have the confidence to make those notes sound as if you intended to play them in that particular sequence. And when you hear someone that breaks out of a group and goes for a solo, that's when you're hearing the true player. I've never really felt that I was ever under Art Tatum's or Nat Cole's shadow, because, as I said earlier, if you hear an improvisationalist, you're hearing the true person. And if you take one of my records or solos and play them with Art Tatum, there's a distinct difference in the delivery. If you can't hear that, then you know nothing about music and less about jazz.
Oscar hasn't only been attacked for being derivative. He's also often been criticized for being fussy and over-ornamented, for playing too many notes. Oscar's defenders say that those who make that claim are ignoring what may be the most underappreciated side of Oscar's artistry. His ability to move tactfully into the background, to become a supportive and unselfish accompanist.
Oscar is a great accompanist. Oh, he can make you blow your lip out.
Trumpeter Harry Sweets Edison.
He was easier to play with than Art Tatum. I hadn't made albums with Art Tatum. He played so much, I didn't know what to play. He was all over the piano. But Oscar, he knows how to accompany you and let you be the star when you're playing.
Playing a lot of piano, being supportive, and staying out of the way. These qualities make Oscar a supreme accompanist. And nowhere did he shine as brightly in that role as when he accompanied singers Sarah Vaughan and Ella Fitzgerald.
Mean to me, why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why I stay.
Playing for Ella was a highlight in my musical life and one I'll never forget. And yet it was one of the easiest things I've ever done because her talent was so rich. It would make you go different ways.
You treat me coldly each day in the year. You always scold me whenever somebody is near, dear. It must be great fun to be mean to me. You shouldn't forget to see what you mean to me.
In the 70s and 80s, Oscar spent more and more of his time composing. He completed the African Suite in 1979, a Royal Wedding Suite in 1981, and the Easter Suite in 1984. All the while, the honors poured in. He received the highest artistic awards in Canada. He won Grammys for Best Jazz Performance in 1975, 77, 78, and 80. Then, in 1990, Oscar came full circle. with a reunion of the original trio with Herb Ellis and Ray Brown at New York's Blue Note Jazz Club.
I think when we went back into the Blue Note with the original trio, it was a reunion, really, in totality. But most importantly, it was a challenge, because various people that heard about it said, "What? You guys are going to get together again? How are you going to find that niche and that groove again?" And we had a very pertinent belief that, if you can play with someone, you can play with them. So we brought in a whole new repertoire of tunes, which I think refreshed the group.
The CD made on that occasion one Oscar, two more Grammys. It was at another engagement at the Blue Note in 1993, when something went terribly wrong. Pianist Benny Green was there.
He suffered a stroke, unbeknownst to all of us in the audience. I was at almost every show that week. Oscar had suffered this stroke on the afternoon of his second evening's performance, and incredibly, he went on with the week, and none of us in the audience knew. I'm a pianist, and I was sitting right next to his feet, watching his feet on the pedal as well as his hands on the keys, and in awe the whole time.
We had slated a performance whereby I was going to do a thing, a solo thing. And I went to play this solo thing, and I couldn't get my left hand to react. So I told Ray, I said, "You're going to have to do this with me, because my left hand is not, there's something wrong." He said, "I know there's something wrong." He said, "What is it?" We couldn't figure out what it was. I wasn't in pain, so maybe I couldn't get to a doctor at that exact moment. And it wasn't until after that that I was examined and said, "Well, you've just undergone a stroke." My dad had several strokes and died from it. All that I realized was that I lost communication with the left side of my body for a while. And I decided that there wasn't much I could do about it. And the first thing I did about it was to go into a depression, for which my wife Kelly was really helpful. And with her backing and everything else, and along with Norman Granz and his wife, I decided that I wasn't going to give it up at that exact moment. I wanted to see how much I could control my body and make myself go out there. And I remember Norman came to the first concert in Copenhagen, and I played that concert, and it was the most difficult thing I think I've ever done, because I knew he was in the audience. And after the concert, we went to a restaurant to have a bite to eat, and he went to the same restaurant. He came in later. I remember he put his arms around me from behind, and he said, "I have to tell you something. I was really proud of you tonight." And I think because of his words and because of the encouragement from my wife and various other people, I decided maybe I wasn't going to give it up altogether then, and that's the reason I'm still playing. I haven't got full command of my left side, but I have enough that I can make it difficult for a couple of piano players. Let's put it that way.
Oscar does make it difficult for more than a couple of piano players. His most recent recordings are evidence of a leaner style, a style that exposes the essence of Oscar Peterson's playing, a profound sense of swing, a comprehensive grasp of the jazz tradition, a lyrical warmth, and above all, a nobility that makes him one of the true aristocrats of jazz. As for the effects of the stroke, Oscar harbors no bitterness.
"No, I'm not angry about having had a stroke. perhaps it's something I needed. That's the way I look at it. Because it's given me a chance to take a sabbatical and look at myself and listen to myself and think about myself. I don't see any room for anger. If anything, it's given me a new will. And as long as I'm able to fulfill my own requirements at the instrument and on stage, I'm going to keep playing.
And Oscar Peterson has kept playing. He's the Johann Sebastian Bach of jazz piano players. There'll never be another like him. Our tribute to Oscar Peterson was produced by David Tarno and written by Eitan Cornfield. Technical assistant, Doug Wright. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Senior editor, Robert Rand. Madeline Smith is the assistant producer. Website coordinator, Bettina Owens. Murray Horowitz is vice president of NPR's cultural programming. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've been listening to an encore broadcast of Jazz Profiles. Pianist Oscar Peterson passed away in 2007 at the age of 82. Discover more great jazz at NPR Music with our series Live at the Village Vanguard, live webcasts and archives from America's premier jazz club. Check it out at nprmusic.org.